Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Right Now Weekly Radio Show, hosted by Vicki Winterton, founder of Expert Insights Publishing, home of best-selling books, award-winning magazines, global broadcasts and communities. Right Now is a highly educational, inspiring, and empowering show focused on writing, publishing, and marketing your books, featuring outstanding guests from across the globe, including best-selling authors, world stage speakers, thought leaders, and visionaries with proven strategies, secret formulas, and treasured resources to help you succeed and make an impact. Welcome. Sit back and enjoy the show. And now your host, Vicki Winterton.
Hi, this is Vicki Winterton, and I'm really happy today because with me I have George McClaire. George has retired from parish ministry for 13 years and is busy doing things he loves, such as spending time with his family and friends, writing, teaching, traveling, conducting ceremonies, and staying as healthy as possible every day. He does a great deal of this with his wife, Linda, and they've been married for 30 years. And George is also amazingly prolific author of wonderful books. And so we're going to talk about his most recent book today. George, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Tell us a little bit about how you came to where you are vocationally. How did you develop the passion and the purpose for all of the great contributions you're making?
Well, my parents were both Pentecostal ordained preachers. And so I started off on this. My mother tells me she took me to church when I was 2 weeks old. And as time went on, I got away from that interpretation of Christianity and went and became a Presbyterian because it just fit me better. You know, it's like having a suit that doesn't fit well, and then you get a new one, custom made, and all of a sudden, you know, it feels wonderful. And so that's what happened to me. I've developed my own adulthood theology, and it is exactly what I need to be doing. And it has led me to being very productive, both in writing and in other things. I was the pastor of the Sausalito Presbyterian Church for just under 27 years, and I've been retired from that for many years, as you just said. And during that time, the last 10 years, I have taught the art of spiritual living at 4 residential drug and alcohol treatment programs. And out of that came my other book, A Guide for Spiritual Living. So I'm just interested in people who are struggling to find a clear way that is safe for them to proceed. And that's what this book is about as well.
So, George, you've made unbelievable contributions in so many different areas, especially your books, because your books really end up going out to people all over the world, potentially. I would love to hear a little bit about your most recent book, the title, what it's about, and what led you to really write the book.
All right. Well, there's a long title. It is, I Hear You're Afraid of Dying, or Afraid Someone You Love Will Die Before You. And believe it or not, this book began when I was in college. I didn't even know it. I became a great fan of Napoleon Hill and his book, Think and Grow Rich. And three things that grabbed me out of that book as a young person was that he said there are three events that most human beings experience. One is getting married and being married. Well, we all know that, you know, nowadays there usually is a lot of preparation for getting married. And, of course, there's an ongoing education about being married in a healthy and happy way. The second one is the birth of children. And even if the birth of a child is an accident or not known, still there's 9 months to prepare. And, of course, there's a lifetime of preparation that just continually goes on. The third event that he talked about was death. And it is different from the other two because many people have no preparation for death. And, of course, once you're dead, there's no chance of preparing after that. And when I tell people, they ask me, well, George, what is your book about? And I give them the title, some of them instantly say, oh, I can't wait till it's out because I need to read that. Or I have a friend whose a partner is dying and he or she needs to read that. But there are some people who literally turn aside and look at me over their shoulder, and you can tell by the look on their face that they don't want to have anything to do with the subject.
That is really interesting, and there is a lot of fear attached to death, I think, for most people. Who do you think is your primary audience in order to reach with this message?
Well, my primary audience are agnostics, atheists, skeptics, and generally people who are not involved in a supportive spiritual community. A lot of Lone Rangers out there. Now, fortunately, all of the groups that I've just mentioned have groups. And the reason I have targeted them is because in a faith-based community, there is a ton of information available. There are rituals, there are traditions, there are songs, there are writings, there are readings, there are meetings, there are wakes, there are this and there are that. And those people don't need another book about this sort of subject. So that's my primary target. But for people who are involved in other communities but have not yet addressed their end-of-life needs, this would be an excellent book for them as well.
You know, George, when we've talked before, you seem to have a certain lightheartedness about the whole process of preparing for dying and actually even about dying itself. Is this approach appropriate considering the usual more serious approach? I mean, do you find that people are accepting of it?
Well, you know, to get to the place where I'm at today, it was a slow burn. I didn't just happen to show up and all of a sudden I was okay about dying. And it took many years for me to get there. When I talk about being lighthearted about this, I'm only talking about my own. I don't have any lightheartedness when it comes to anybody else's death. And they're all the people who are close to me, my wife, my son, his wife, and other friends, and I have a whole bunch of friends I call 3 a.m. friends. These are people who you can literally call at 3 in the morning and talk and say, you know, let's meet down the corner, I'm in big trouble, or something like that. All of those people, I have a high anxiety about their death, of them dying before I do. But my own, I think it's just because I've been exposed to so many deaths. You know, I've been in the pastorate now for 47 years, and I've done several hundred memorial services and met with people who are very, very religious and others who have never seen the inside of a church or a synagogue or a temple. And I see that many people are very, very afraid of this subject. And even though they know they should get involved in it, they don't know where to begin. And so I have a lighthearted attitude about the whole thing because of my experience and because I think people need this rather than the old-fashioned dogma, deadly serious kind of thing all the time.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Absolutely couldn't agree more. I know that some people have expressed to me that they don't want to focus on death because they're worried about the fact that it could bring death on faster if they concentrate on it, talk about it.
Okay.
Can you comment on that a little bit?
Absolutely. Some people are involved in a culture that believes in superstition, and a kissing cousin to that is magical thinking. Now, magical thinking is usually used in describing young children who do something bad and then a parent has an accident. And in their limited experience, they say, well, the reason Molly fell and broke her wrist is because I told her I didn't like her anymore. And they put that together. That's magical thinking. But I know some people, and we've had these conversations, and one was at our house when we were talking about our will, and my wife Linda said to this woman, you wouldn't have a conversation like this with your parents, would you? And she said, oh, no, no, no. We never talk about anything like that. But I think that's what it is. The other thing, of course, are, you know, the fear of death is overwhelming for some people. I mean, they literally won't do it. I am dealing right now with a woman who is making out her memorial service and writing her obituary. But her husband won't have a thing to do with it. He doesn't want to read it. He doesn't want to talk about it. And it's almost like there's a dangerous animal in the room. And he doesn't want to approach that dangerous animal. And so she meets with me and we go through this. And then another factor, of course, is the fear of change. I mean, some people do not like change and they just want to go along. And then, of course, I think the final reason that the people don't want to talk about this is because they procrastinate about everything, and so they're going to procrastinate, and it's going to continue on until they die.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've lost just about all of my family members other than the love of my life. There is no one in my, no one in an immediate relation in my sphere here on Earth anymore, and I experienced it where people have really been well prepared. And I have experienced it where I've been in charge of things where it's not been well prepared for what happens after death. And it's a tremendous burden to carry the sadness along with all of the details of death when you leave that to someone to do that you love.
Absolutely.
You know, as opposed to the other point of view where people are well prepared, it's certainly, for me, it's still a sad event. But it's, you know, it's just, it's not also compromised emotionally by all of the things, the details that have to be done. And so I think, even, you know, even thinking beyond yourself and thinking to those you leave behind is such a good reason to prepare, both from a physical standpoint as well as an emotional and spiritual standpoint.
It really is. And I'll tell you where this came to me. A married woman with three children came down with cancer, and she contacted me. And for the next year and a half or so, I met with her a couple of times and visited her both in the hospital and at her home. And she went through the treatment, sometimes getting better and sometimes not. And one day she called and she said, "George, I am not going to beat this, and I want you to come over to my place, and I want to plan my memorial service." Well, that was the first time I ever heard of such a thing. And so we went over, and she did. Her service from the beginning to the end was her service. And when the service began, the pastor of that church announced that she had created a service. And I'm telling you, the difference between that service and a service that just the leader organizes without family input is night and day. Now, she had three children, as I told you. So she picked out four speakers, four different people that she wanted to speak, and she asked me to talk directly to their children because my dad had died when I was five.
Oh.
So her children, who were 7, 6, and 4, she wanted me to talk to them about my experience, and I did. Now, since then, I have conducted probably 20 or 25 services where the person who died organized the total service with somebody else or with me. And the difference between a prepared service like that and one that is not prepared is literally night and day. And I'll give you another story. So the mortuary calls me to do a service for a family I don't know. And so I go over to the house, and there's a regular door and a screen door. And he says, "Are you the Rev?" And I said, "I am." And he says, "Okay, Rev, we got a question for you. And if the answer is no, we're getting another Rev." And I said, "Okay, well, what's the question?" He said, "My father died, and his favorite song in the whole world was Home, Home on the Range by Gene Autry. Can we play that during the service?" And I said, "You bet we can." And he opened the door, and he said, "Come on in. You want a beer?" And I'm telling you, during the service, when we played that Home, Home on the Range, it was magnificent. And it is the only thing now I remember about the service, other than the fact, you know, people thoroughly enjoyed it. And what you said before about doing this sort of thing being a very, very big gift to the rest of the family and those who are going to conduct the ceremony is a huge, huge, huge gift.
It is, no question. And as I said, I've been a recipient of it, and I've been in situations where that has not been the case, and there's just no question how enormous that gift is, no question. So, you know, I know that your book and your teachings have an enormous amount of material, And, you know, there's a full range of all kinds of issues that you cover. And I just wonder if it is appropriate for people, do you think, and advisable for people to maybe approach this kind of piece by piece as opposed to trying to take in all of it at one time?
Yes. First of all, even in the book, I say I don't think everybody is going to do all of these suggestions, but it's kind of picking the thing that you're going to do. And people can see the table of contents right now on my Facebook page with the title, I Hear You're Afraid of Dying. You can read the table of contents there. And there are a lot of exercises. For instance, in the very beginning, there are four charts of anxiety level about dying. And that's divided into a high anxiety, which are things like, I have nightmares and wake up sweating. I'm afraid God's not forgiven me of my greatest crimes. And one of the sentences that is in there is really a lot of fun, and that is, just reading the title of this book is extremely disturbing. I won't even read your book now or ever. So that's a person with high anxiety. And the next chart is medium, moderate anxiety, and then low anxiety. Then we have thinking about somebody dying before us, but not us, but somebody else. That's all high anxiety. And so the idea there is to kind of take an inventory of where you are about this subject as a way of beginning, and then go through the book and pick out the various things that you want to deal with.
And I know that you have a number of charts that help readers really identify anxiety and where it's coming to them specifically regarding dying or someone else dying. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. It's very, very important for us to tell ourselves the truth. And this comes out of the fourth step in the AA program, where we make a honest evaluation of our life and with no holds barred. And if a person is an alcoholic or a drug addict, they go back to the very beginning of the habit and move on to when it became an addiction and how it ruined and wrecked their lives and all that happened with it. So I'm taking that same approach and saying, all right, when it comes to death, let's put our cards on the table face up. And once they are on the table face up, we can then begin to work through the process. And that's what those charts are all about. It's a self-evaluation. It is not somebody else judging you.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And for people, that's a gift to yourself to be able to go through that process.
Well, it is.
Still here.
It's a wonderful gift, and making an evaluation of our entire lifetime is great for non-addicts as well as addicts.
Yeah, no question. So what led you to decide to encourage people to write a plan around everything to do with death, their own memorial service, funeral, celebration of life? Why did that become something you felt was so important for people to really focus on?
The reason is out of the experience that I had between doing services where people prepare and where people do not prepare. The vast majority of memorial services that I have done, I go to the home and I sit down with a family who is in complete disarray. They have never done this before, or they have done it before and it was so dreadful they don't want to do it again. And they obviously wish the person hadn't died, but the planning is almost overwhelming. And so when you have an instrument like I've written here, it is an easy, friendly, safe way to approach the subject. And the people will actually get over their fear of death as they go through the book and as they do the exercises and as they answer the question and as they make decisions. For example, one great decision to make about your end of life, a moral service or celebration of life, is what music do you want? Now, I've been doing this exercise myself now for many years, and I look at my memorial service outline maybe once or twice a year, and I always change the music because I'm growing and developing and I'm interested in other things. But some of the readings that I have, they're still the same, and I've written a poem to be read at my memorial service, and my wife feels 100% better now that she knows exactly what I want as she did before. And I think anybody who reads the book and anybody who approaches this will begin doing that. That's my same experience with the death cafes. Do you know about the death cafe movement?
No, I don't.
All right, well, it's a fairly new, just several years old, and it's a group of people. Usually there are seven or eight people, although the last one I went to, there were 50 of us. And the person who's in charge asks some questions. The first question on the last one was, what are you going to do if you have 12 months to live? Well, that's a great question. And some people, they said, well, I'm going to take the trip that I never thought I could afford, and I didn't have time for it. Another person would say, well, you know, that sounds like a good idea, but if you have 12 months to live, you might not feel up to taking that trip. And so if you want to take that trip, you better get to it right now. And so that's what that Death Cafe movement is all about, is freely talking about what is going on. And by the way, in the last room that I was in dealing with this, they had a little plastic elephant in the middle of the room. It was just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful symbol of things we do not want to talk about. But here, again, I use the illustration of putting our cards on the table face up. And when we do that, when we face our fear directly, the fear begins to dissipate. And it might not dissipate in an hour. It may take weeks. It may take months. But after a while, it will dissipate.
That is absolutely amazing. And I had not heard about that. That is just incredible. So I have a question to ask you. Assuming that you have accepted death, which you mentioned earlier, that you have a much easier time with that for yourself than for the loved ones around you, how did you come to that place for yourself?
Well, I'll tell you how I came to it. It was a gradual process. As I mentioned earlier, my dad died when I was 5. So I've been dealing with death literally all of my life. And then over the years, some people close to me, a 12-year-old girl, one of my roommates, she died. And then, of course, once I became a pastor, then I got involved in death and dying on a very regular basis. And it just became less frightening for me. But the one thing that I was afraid of when I was young, I was afraid of dying because I was afraid of God. And the theology that my parents had is that we stand before Almighty God, and, you know, we are judged on our merits and on our sins. And if you're not found eligible to enter the pearly gates, you end up in a torture chamber for the rest of existence. I mean, that's pretty frightening. And I do not believe that that God actually exists, but I do believe that God's influence exists because people are afraid. And so once I realized that that idea about God was false, and the God that exists, I don't know what shape or form that God is, but whatever God exists is a loving God, not a punishing God. And I have stopped using the word God very much. The term I use is the creator of existence, and the name that I identify for that is the great mystery. Because it's a Teflon name. Nothing can be attached to it. Then the second great fear I had was the fear of non-existence. So that here my physical body would die and that'd be it. It'd be over. And that literally did frighten me. One day when we were dating, I mentioned that to Linda, and she said, well, you don't have to be afraid of that. And I said, why? She said, because if there is nothing after life, you're just going to go to sleep and you won't know it anyway. And I'm telling you, that wiped the slate clean. For me, that worked. And those are the things that got me comfortable in dealing with my own death. The other thing is, goes back to Carlos Castaneda's writings where he was talking to Don Juan, his teacher. And Don Juan said to him, you know, Carlos, you need to become an impeccable warrior. And Carlos says, I don't even know what an impeccable warrior is. And Don Juan says, an impeccable warrior is someone who is not willing to do something unless it's okay for that to be their last act on earth. Now, we can't live that way, but I love that whole concept. And so what I try to do each day is to live as an impeccable warrior at least for a few minutes. And for instance, now here I'm doing this interview with you, so I am perfectly fine to just be the last thing that I ever do in this world. So if I fall down the stairs and I'm dead, at least I would have made this contribution, and for me, it's enough.
That is absolutely beautiful. Beautiful. So now I have a complex question for you. I find it complex sometimes for me. If you have people in your life that you love and you have a fear of losing them, and how do you balance the idea of if they're doing things that aren't constructive in their life and that fear of losing them as a result of this unconstructive behavior is there, and yet you love them and respect them from the standpoint of making their own decisions. How do you balance that, George?
Well, I tell you, my experience around that has to do with friends that I know who are addicts and recovering addicts. And the best thing I can do is I can be honest with them, not in a judgmental way, but say to them, is what you are doing, is it contributing to your health, or is there a possibility that this could kill you? And, you know, people aren't stupid. Addicts aren't stupid. And people who are doing things that are a violation of their body, mind, and spirit, they know it at some level. And what they need is somebody who knows all of that about them and still loves them and still express the fact, you know, I'm concerned about you. I want you to live. I want you to be healthy, and to approach it that way. Now, in order to have a conversation like that, what I do is I write that person a therapeutic letter. A therapeutic letter is a letter that you write but never send. And the highest level of therapeutic writing is that you never show it to anybody ever. Because if you know somebody is going to read it, you'll censor it, either consciously or unconsciously. And this therapeutic letter is a way of getting it all out there. So I can give my sadness in its greatest form during writing that letter. And I can find out by writing the letter what I can say and what I can't say. But here's the final of all of this, and that is, no matter what goes on, keep the conversation going. That is, don't cut a person off just because they continually say to you, well, I don't use anymore, when you know they do. And that's one of the things that we need to do. We need to be patient. We need to be kind. We need to be thoughtful. But we also need to put our cards on the table and say, you know, I think what's going on with you is they're going to kill you if you keep it up. I'll tell you a great story. So in 1999, I had a heart attack, and I had two stents put in, and then afterwards I went through a program called Total Arterial Sclerosis Management. And a doctor was leading it, and we there were about a dozen of us. We're all workaholics, killing ourselves and loving every minute. And he said, now that you have your plumbing fixed, you probably think you're home free. And I did, because I had said to my wife, as soon as these drugs wear off, I'm going to be back, meaning at my full speed. And he said, if you live in the future as you have lived in the past, you're going to have another heart attack, and it's going to kill you. And I said to myself, wow, I'm at the right place at the right time, successfully engaged in the right activity. That program saved my life. And it saved my life because there was nothing but truth in the room the whole time that we met. I think we met twice a week for 8 weeks or something of that sort. And that is what we can say to people. It is the same thing. If you live in the future, like you have lived in the past, eventually you're going to wake up dead.
That's so powerful. So powerful, George. So how do you ease the concern about losing someone that you love? Because you said that was more difficult for you than your own death. What have you used to help you through that?
Well, what I have used is just what I said, and that is therapeutic writing. I have written more than one letter to my wife about the fact that I might lose her. And I even wrote a poem called The Greatest Loss of My Life. And I gave that to her one day as an anniversary present. And I've written the same letter to my son, and three or four other people who have been with me since I was young. And there's no softiness. There's no way of getting over it. All you can do is be as kind to yourself as possible in telling yourself the truth and facing the fact that you're going to lose this person sometime in the near future.
Mm. Wow. That's wonderful. This therapeutic writing, I've never heard it referred to that way before. That's just a beautiful thing, and what a wonderful tool. Such a generous tool for you to offer up for us.
I was just going to mention now, therapeutic writing is also therapeutic doodling, scribbling, painting, drawing, sculpting. I have a friend who is a recovering alcoholic, and he's relapsed three or four times. He's a magnificent artist, and he has drawn several pictures, they're black and white, of his addiction. And if you saw those, he's never shown them to anybody but me so far. I tried to get copies of them so I could put them in my book, but he wouldn't hear of it. But even if you didn't know him, and if you just walked in the room and you saw those drawings, you would say, ha, that's terrifying. That's very disturbing, because he put his whole experience into drawing those pictures. And then, so I'm suggesting the same thing with other people. You do whatever skill you have, and you're only inhibited by your imagination.
Mm, that's so fabulous. The idea that there's a whole range of creative ways to approach this. Really wonderful. Whatever inspires you. So, George, I was wondering, with all of the great work you're doing and you've done, and now especially with this book, if you were to look at this as far as expanding out globally to really impact the world, almost like a legacy, what would you like your book and your work to represent people from the standpoint of accepting death?
Well, I want to be a small part of the shift that goes on in our culture when it comes to talking about our own death and preparing and planning for it. And that's beginning. The Death Cafe is one example, but there are a number of others. There are other groups. A friend of mine goes to a group. Stephen Levine wrote a magnificent book called 12 Months to Live. And that group of about a dozen people, they've been studying that book for several months. And again, all people can find another person or two or three or five or ten who is at the place in their life where they are now willing to talk about the subject. And that's the impact that I would like to have on our culture.
Hmm. I just love it. I just love it, and I love the time with you, George. And I wanted to mention that I had a near-death experience about 2.5 years ago where I'd been helping my whole life, and really I have been workaholically abusive toward a lot of travel and long hours and just achieved a lot of success, and I love what I've done. But I was not one to slow down and ended up with blood clots to my lungs that almost killed me. And it was very, very severe and required being airlifted out of our place in the mountains and full week and a half in ICU. But the reason I wanted to mention this is I so identify with all the things you've said, because one of the things I decided was that it wasn't my time to go yet. I'm really clearly in that helicopter made that decision. It was almost like an agreement with God. And the other side of it was that where I used to look at the quality of my life by hours and days, I now look at it in minutes, literally minutes. It's so present time. So I wanted to share that with you, George, because I just think that what you're doing with this book and the work that you're doing is so unbelievably powerful and important for people, not just from the standpoint of accepting dying, but the standpoint of appreciating the moments they have left on this earth.
Yes, and I love the fact that you mentioned that, because my heart attack did something similar to me. It was kind of like the opening of a new lifetime, and a lifetime not where I expect to live to be 95, but a lifetime where I expect I might be dead in 20 minutes. And as dreadful as that sounds, for some people who are afraid of dying, to me, it is a freeing thing. And since my heart attack, I spend money much more easily than I used to.
Yeah, yeah. And probably more selective about how you spend your time.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And another thing about completion is my wife and I, a year and a half ago, completed our bucket list. So that's another completion that we need to get to, because one of the saddest things that I read about is a couple who were going to be married, and they got passports, and the next thing happened is the man got killed a week or so before the wedding, and here, something that they had planned on doing, they never got to do. Yeah. And so I'm big on the bucket list and making sure that you complete that as quickly as possible.
Yeah, yeah. And just celebrate life. And you are absolutely an amazing person to celebrate life. And I'm so glad we've had this time together and be able to celebrate life with you. I just thank you so much for all you bring. And I know that our listeners will want to learn more from you. Is there a website or somewhere where they can go to connect?
My website is simply my name, my last name, McLaird, McLaird.com.
Fabulous. And I hope everyone will connect with George there and really take advantage of all the other wonderful things that he has to offer in the way of wisdom and tremendous inspiration in this area that's so important. George, thank you again. It was just
a pleasure. You're welcome, and people can go to my website and start blogging about their experience, their fears, or whatever.
Perfect. So beautiful.
Thank you so much,
George, for your generosity.
I really appreciate being on with you. Thank you.
And for those of you who would like to learn more about Expert Insights Publishing, our best-selling books, award-winning magazines, our global broadcasts, and communities, you can find us at getei.com. That's GETEI.com, and everyone have a fabulous week.